Hello, this is a Spotlight on Art programme, and we're very pleased today to be joined by Nicholas Daniel, who's the Creative Director of Leicester's International Music Festival. How are you? Is it Nick or Nicholas? Which would you prefer?
Nick's fine, thank you. Yes, I'm really well, thank you. I'm in the middle of moving house, so I'm surrounded by packing boxes, so I've escaped to my car.
Well, it sounds fine, and there's lots of people who are online these days doing TikTok videos and things from the cars. Hope you're not going to be one of those people who has a meltdown in the car.
No, and I'm not going to start giving you advice, I promise.
Oh, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. So tell us a little bit about yourself, and then we'll get into the detail of the festival.
Yeah, well, I'm a musician. My instrument is the oboe, which is not a normal instrument it's not like violin or piano. It's a woodwind instrument that if you ever to hear a concert and you hear the tuning note of an orchestra, that's the oboe that gives that note. So I started off my career when I was 18 years old by winning BBC Young Musician of the Year. That was a long time ago. You'd have to have a very good memory to remember it, because I'm in my early 60s now. But it was in 1980. And in those days, a lot of people watched it. So it was like 18, 20 million people watched the thing. So it made me a bit of a household name, and my instrument became more famous as a result of it. So I've been lucky to have a kind of solo career really on my instrument, which is a wonderful thing. So in addition to that, I'm a teacher. So I'm a professor of my instrument. And I also for many years have run this fantastic little festival that we have in Leicester, the word classical does tend to put people off, but it really means great music. It means serious music. It means intense music. It means music that makes you feel things. And it makes you happy, and it makes you sad, and it makes you, you know, feel different stuff, which is what really great music does. Any genre of great music does that. But we tend to focus on music sometimes by dead composers, sometimes by living composers. And in fact, in this year's festival, we've got a fantastic composer who's going to be present in Leicester for the whole festival. Her name is Emma Ruth Richards. And yes, women compose too, if anybody was wondering.
and it's a combination of well-known and new work then.
Exactly right, yeah.
So what's the more familiar things that people, the listeners, would maybe pick up on?
Well, there's a composer called Schubert who we're featuring, because Schubert both mends hearts and breaks them. It's got two of the really great Schubert pieces, the Trout Quintet, which is very, very famous piece, which is for piano and strings with a double bass. Got the first fantastic double bass player, Linda Houghton, who's coming up. And she's from the Academy of St. Martin in the Fields, and she's just a star. And then we've got the Great String Quintet, which is just one of the most amazing pieces ever written, which is for two violins, viola, and two cellos. And so we've got Schubert breaking hearts, mending hearts. And then we've got this composer called Maurice Ravel. And Ravel was a French composer who was born 150 years ago. So we're celebrating his biggest birthday so far. And if you've heard that, if you've seen that film, Call Me By Your Name, there's a wonderful solo piano piece, and that's by Ravel. So it's very dreamy, very romantic sounding music. And it's a contrast to the Schubert, because Schubert is so delicate and special, and Ravel is more highly perfumed. And so they're fantastic composers anybody, they're a child anybody could love. And alongside that, we've got mostly quite short pieces by this wonderful British composer, Emma Ruth Richards, who's in her mid-30s. She's a prize-winning composer. She's very, very successful. And she's coming along to be with us and to explain her music and to talk about it. There's one event which we've got, which is entirely of her music, which I'll talk about perhaps a little bit later. But that's a very special event at the Attenborough Centre. But otherwise, we've got fairly short pieces that will be explained well, so you don't have to be afraid that it's squeaky modern music. And she'll be there, and she's very approachable and lovely.
I'd say the theme is vibrant landscapes. Have I got that correct? Yeah. So it's right. I mean, because the thought that comes to mind, it's for most people, it's the setting, isn't it? You know, it's the intimacy of the venues of the Leicester's New York Museum.
Well, actually, the new York Museum is closed at the moment for us. So, in fact, we're in this beautiful Hanson Hall, the Pork Pie, which is it's a adult education center just at the top of town. And it's just at the bottom of New York. And in fact, we've had the most wonderful success in that venue because it's warm in the winter. It's not too hot in the summer. It's acoustically. So what that means is the actual sound, the resonance in the building is really, really suitable for classical music. So it's clear, but it's extremely beautiful sounding. So you get a very all-round warm experience in there. We're doing our best to make the lighting seem atmospheric. But it's also just a fantastic venue, really easy to walk to from town, easy from the station if you're not from inside Leicester. Some of our events are not in the evening, so there's no need to come out every single evening. Vibrant landscapes, one of the reasons I called it that is because both Schubert and Ravel often are painting pictures themselves with their music. And so Schubert was a famous composer of songs, but in fact, we've not got a single song being performed in the festival. There's no singers this year. We had two singers last year. But as a song composer, he's always painting a picture, beautiful picture. Ravel also always painting beautiful, stunning pictures. The first piece I'm playing is all about a jester. So it's a bit like perhaps a Picasso of a jester making fun and having fun with the king. And then actually the major piece which we're playing by Emma Ruth Richards is actually called Still Life. And that's one of the reasons that the whole festival's got this title, Vibrant Landscapes, because I was looking for a title that would describe how vivid the music is for me. So I program pieces that I love, and I don't want to hear pieces I don't love. And so my feeling is that if I have a strong enough program of strong enough pieces, that I'll gather together an audience who will like it. And it's not everybody likes every single piece, but I would say on balance, people really, really enjoy the concerts. And we've actually at Hanson, we've built our audience quite considerably from where we were. I mean, we were not doing too badly, but after COVID, it was really hard for all the live arts. So it's been interesting to watch it build back up. And what I like to do is to bring the audience with me. So I'll stretch them a little bit with some new music, but not too much of it. But then I'll put in, you know, really great classics so that people know they're going to hear something that they're familiar with, but also something that they, if they're not familiar with it, that they will almost certainly love it.
So this is Spotlight and Art with Rob Watson here on Saw Sound. And I'm talking today with Nicholas Daniel, who's the creative director of the Leicester International Music Festival. Now, would you say that Leicester is well known for its music? It's not well known as a destination for music.
That's not strictly true.
Because, okay, I'm happy to be corrected.
Yeah, well, I mean, the thing is, the Philharmonia is resident at De Montfort Hall, and they have a fantastic series. Our festival's been going for nearly 30 years. Every single year, even during COVID, we carried it on. We did it online. We have a loyal and very supportive audience. We have a lunchtime series, which goes all the way through the year from the beginning of October until the end of March, every other Thursday. And that's at Hanson Hall at the moment. It will be back end of next year to be back in the New York Museum. There's been string quartet series in Leicester over the years. There's two very fine amateur orchestras based in Leicester, the Bardi and the Leicester Symphony Orchestra. I myself used to be the music director of the Leicester Symphony Orchestra. It was founded by Sir Malcolm Sargent. It might not be Birmingham or Manchester, or even perhaps Halifax, but it's certainly not London. But Leicester has a loyal and devoted music audience. And it also, let's not forget, it has an extraordinary audience for other sorts of musical art. So it's got a very big audience for North and South Asian music. It has a good audience for jazz. And of course, it has all sorts of fantastic attractions. So I would say that even if it's not the most obvious destination on the classical circuit, it's definitely known for it. It's definitely got what I would describe as a really vibrant art scene. And I mean, one of the things we do with the work that I want to do with the festival, the work we all as a committee and as a group want to do, is we invite young people to come. So we have a family concert which is on Saturday week.
Friday the 19th, Saturday the 20th.
Saturday the 20th. So that family concert is free to attend, and anybody can come to it with a child or with a parent or a guardian. And it's where they will hear short excerpts of some of the pieces we've played in the concert. They'll meet a real life composer who just happens to be a woman. That's a cool thing for girls to see, that women can compose too, because it's still not that well known that women are just as good at composing music as men. And why the hell shouldn't they be? So that's a really good thing. And I introduce it, and I love family concerts. I love children's concerts. And I make it fun for them, and we might do a conga while people are playing, and we'll just have a good time. Nothing lasts too long, but there'll be serious music as well as funny music. There'll be a chance to meet all of my amazing players, and we've got an extraordinary group of players. We've got two violinists, a viola player, two cellists, a fantastic pianist, and me on the oboe, double bass, and those people come from really all over the world in many ways. I mean, the cellist and the first violinist are both flying in from Finland. People are coming in from London. Ashok Kluda, who's one of our cellists, who's amazing, is also coming from London. So it's really a tremendously broad group. And I would like to think that anybody could come and hear our music and hear half of a concert, and the tickets are really not that expensive, and all the seats are good in the hall. So you can come and hear a concert, and you could come to hear half a concert or a whole concert, and you probably will stay because you come to the first half, because you'll probably like it. That's the truth. And we just have a really good time on stage. It's a group of friends. It's not like I brought a string quartet in. It's different to that. So what I do is I choose people that I think will really work together, and I know have worked together in the past, and I bring them together, and we all stay in Leicester, and we all go out for fantastic curries, and we all have a really good time together, and we rehearse and we give these concerts. It's very intense way of making music, but it really, really works. It's fantastic family feel. In fact, the cellist and the violinist are bringing their one-year-old baby with them, so all the way from Finland with her mum, who's doing the babysitting. It's all these things behind the stage.
And what do you look forward to in terms of the reaction from people, both your colleagues and the co-organisers of the festival, and then also the members of the public?
Well, that's a really good question. I mean, the colleagues, we will be having fun, but it'll be intense, because we've really got to concentrate. It's put together fairly fast, but they're absolutely brilliant players, but they're really concentrating. So the release of doing it, it's not like we're on tour and we're doing it 15 times in a row in different cities. We do it once and then it's gone. We're not recording it. We're not taping it. We're not videoing it. It's once and then it's gone. So it's very intense, great fun. I hope that the committee who I work with, who do such fantastic work, absolutely for love, I hope that they will feel that all their hard work over the year has been worthwhile, and that they can just sit and relax and enjoy the music that they love. I mean, the choice of pieces is done collaboratively. I have ideas and they either agree or suggest other things with me.
So I want to focus a little bit on you now, Nick. What's your story in terms of why you're so passionate for this? What how come you've got to this point where you're, you know, the advocate for this, and what's driven you along the way in terms of what you find in music that motivates? And
very good question. Well, my father was a prison officer, and my mother did old ladies' feet, and I'm not from a posh family. I know I'm quite well spoken, but the thing is that because I showed quite a lot of talent early on, particularly with singing, I was able to be a choir boy at Salisbury Cathedral. And that was all on scholarships. And then I went to a specialist music school in London called the Purcell School. That was also on scholarships. And my parents certainly couldn't afford private school fees. And I was a complete oddball inside my family. I mean, I do have a cousin who's a very well-known singer, funnily enough. It's just popped out in this generation of mine. But I think one of the reasons why I love doing this festival so much is because my instrument, the oboe, I mean, often if I would hop in a cab or something and say, they'd start talking and say, well, what do you do? I said, well, I play the oboe. If they say the what? Even when my grandmother told my mother that I should play the oboe, my mother said, what the beeps? An oboe. She did use the F-bomb, I have to say. Because my grandmother knew about
fiddle.
It.
Fiddle. She said, the fiddle is there.
What the fiddle's an oboe. My grandmother knew about it because of the theme tune of Emmerdale used to be played on the oboe, you see. But so what happens is that my instrument is comparatively limited in some ways. And I'm a very, I'm a graduate of the University of Life. I haven't got a university degree. I haven't even got a music degree. When I went to the Royal Academy, there was no degrees there at that time. I did a 3-year performance course and tried to avoid all the academic work I possibly could. On one of my reports, I think it was my maths report, the teacher said, where is Nick Daniel? Who is Nick Daniel? Because I was never turning up. So basically, my instrument is comparatively limited in some ways in terms of repertoire. So it's got a lot from the 18th century, very little in the 19th century, and then the 20th century it came back. But that romantic period of music, so you know, the Chopin, the Beethoven, the Rachmaninoff, there's nothing for my instrument. So I have a desire to enjoy that music and to share it with people, but I can't play it. So it's one of the reasons I've also become a conductor, because I want to conduct all those pieces that there's not a piece for my instrument. And it's exactly the same. I find myself to be a creative person. I absolutely love spending time with an idea, I get a theme idea in my head, and then I think about how it'll all fit together like a jigsaw puzzle. So the festival is most intense for me than for anybody, because all of these things I've imagined are coming together and being put together in the way that I imagine them in my mind. So I would like to think that I have a gift for it in a way. I've been lucky to discover that I had a gift for programming. And I think that it's really to do with the way you show things off against each other. It's like a really great meal. You know, you've got your starter, you've got your main course, you've got your pudding. And actually, you might not have it in that order in classical music. You might start with something fairly short. You might have your main course at the end and something, you know, very challenging, like a very spicy in the middle, or very colorful in the middle that throws things off and shows off the other side of it. So I do think of it in terms of really enjoying the contrast of the music. And so I think I have a belief that if you've got somebody who believes in what they do, then they will gather around them people who enjoy that style. So that's really what's happened in Leicester over. I mean, I've been doing this for more than 20 years in Leicester, and we've been through, you know, difficult times when the audience, perhaps I was moving too fast for them. And I learned a lot from that. And we had to move venues once again. We were very nervous last year about moving venues this year, but actually Hanson Hall has been an absolute blessing. And it's been great to see audience coming back after COVID, feeling gradually more and more safe and less worried. Because, you know, some of our audience are old, a lot of them actually quite young. We have quite a lot of school groups coming in, but they're very, very well behaved. The other thing that we do is that on the Friday, we'll be taking two of our players round to several different schools, a retirement community, and to a fantastic youth club. They'll be doing a sort of like a mobile band in a can, going around to different places and transporting our music out to them. So we don't only expect people to come to us, we also go to them. So it's a combination of things, and the education side of it, with whatever money we've got, we do as much education work as we can.
You're listening to Spotlight on Arts with me, Rob Watson, here on Source Sound, and I'm talking with Nick Daniel, who's the creative director of the Leicester International Music Festival. This is taking you around the world.
It does.
Performance and programming. Yeah. What's that kind of global perspective given you?
Well, it's given me I have to say that the combination of traveling and being at home has given me enormous perspective, because Leicester's a very different city. I've always lived fairly rurally. And of course, I've been working in cities my whole life, but actually Leicester's a very, very unusual city. And I think an extremely, in many ways, a very successful and interesting city. And I've learned a lot from the sort of openness to the white minority there and the openness to all the different cultures that it's possible to experience in Leicester. And one of the reasons I started doing it in the very first place, the reason I applied for the job was because of 9/11, because I thought there must be a way that music has a way of bringing people together. And, you know, it's really hard to get people from non-white groups to come to our music because they say, it's not my bag, man. And I say, well, actually, it is your bag. It's everybody's bag. It's your cultural heritage as part of this community and as someone who lives in this country. And it is your heritage. The music is not English. It's not British. It's German and French. And there's one British composer, and she happens to be a British woman in her mid-30s. So why is that not for you? So I think the thing is, so often people are just not exposed to enough classical at school. But it honestly is the kind of thing that I believe anybody can enjoy. And if you just come to the family concert and you suddenly find that those pieces are making you, you know, really turning your brain into like firing on all cylinders, that's a really good thing. So it's funny how long ago it started for that reason. And but the global perspective is fascinating. I mean, it changes all the time. So America at the moment is, I would say, a difficult place to travel to. There's so many challenges there. The arts are in desperate trouble there. Whereas actually China, where I've just come back from and have been to twice in the last 10 months, is an absolutely glowing classical world. You've got an enormous middle class in China who are comparatively wealthy. And so for them, the instruments that we would find very expensive to buy for kids in the UK are actually for them quite cheap comparatively. And actually, they're really starting to show their talent, those people in that country. And so they are in places like Venezuela, in South America, and countries like Australia has, well, they call it tall poppy, because tall poppy syndrome, because the Australians can produce some absolutely amazing people. Then they have to leave the country to kind of become successful. Then they go back and they're called tall poppies. So it's funny how things go in and out of focus. I mean, Eastern Europe still has, so for instance, Poland, Bulgaria, Romania still have fantastic classical going on, partly because of EU investments. So they're getting great concert halls built with EU money, which of course we don't have the access to anymore. But they really do seem to be, they have a great tradition in those countries. Of course, the one place which I used to go to quite a lot, which is you now really can't go to, nor would I want to, is Russia. And that is tragic because Russian music is some of the great, great, great music, particularly romantic music, Tchaikovsky, Rachmaninoff, Glinka, Mussorgsky. They're incredible composers. It's an absolute Shostakovich, of course. It's a tragedy, really, in a way. And I do have friends in Russia, and they're just praying they don't get called up for the draft to go and fight in the Ukraine. So, and of course, I've got many, many Ukrainian friends who are also in absolutely desperate trouble. So seeing these countries go in and out of a sort of polarity is really fascinating over, I guess, 45 years of traveling the world and doing my job. Yeah.
I mean, we in many ways with, if you call it serious music, it's we forget sometimes. I mean, Beethoven was writing at the time of the French, you know, in response to the rise of Napoleon and the you know, the after effects of the French Revolution and the rise of the Enlightenment. And
totally,
what do you think? Who are the composers that you look to that are saying things about those things about our society today that we can't yet put our finger on the button and say, this is what it is, but it comes through in art, doesn't it? It comes through in the feelings
very
that you get through
so.
Music. Is there anybody that we can be looking for that you're keen on?
I mean, I think there's two composers, and funnily enough, they're both composers that are religious in different ways. And they're, I would describe them as religious minimalists. And what that means is they use quite minimal techniques, repetitive techniques, to create a sort of meditative state. So it's very, very tonal. It's very, very easy to listen to. But something like Arvo Pärt, the Estonian absolute master who's in his early 90s, or the late Sir John Taverner, who was a very close friend of mine and who wrote a lot for me, or someone like Henrik Goretzky. Now, at the Proms the other day, we heard the Symphony of Sorrowful Songs. Now, Symphony of Sorrowful Songs, which is Symphony number 3, was at the top of the pop charts in the 1980s. The pop charts, not the specialist classical chart. And that's because it's the most incredible music, which speaks to the, I think, the soul of the human being in a way that our modern society, the speed of our modern society, is creating a need for us to have a spiritual realm in our lives. And what's really great about the music of Taverner or Goretzky or Arvo Pärt is that you can actually you don't have to go to any kind of church or synagogue or anything. You don't have to be religious to actually appreciate what that does. So it actually has a sort of effect of making the body and the mind just slow down for a little bit.
So Nick, what's your view of the kind of so for example, the director, I can't remember the guy's name, the director of Wigmore Hall talked about not taking any more funding from the Arts Council because they want to focus and concentrate on excellence. And then at the other side, you've kind of got, and I'm going to betray myself as being a massive snob here, is the kind of the classic FM kind of regurgitating Vivaldi type stuff. And, you know, how do we identify music that is for us and tells us about who we are as a community, as individuals, rather than looking to all of these cues that we get in the media, in broader society, that saying that this is what you should like? How do we decide for ourselves?
Well, I think the thing is that it, in the same way that if you're in any way experimental with what you eat, I mean, sometimes like my husband's a great gym rat. So he always says, I said, what are we having for dinner? He says, we have chicken. I said, no, I've had chicken 3 times this week. No more chicken. So I said, okay, look, I'll go and buy some fish and I'll do something nice with it. I'll do it in the oven with matchstick vegetables, a little bit of this. He says, but no lemon or lime because he gets indigestion. I'm like, oh my God. But the fact is that if you can just sample a few things, I think Classic FM has been one of the great game changers for classical in this country. I was lucky enough to be someone who in their first, they had 100 recordings and they would just play them day in, day out. One of my recordings was one of those. And I didn't make much money from it, but I saw audiences at my concerts increase by at least 50% over the time that Classic FM started. BBC Radio 3 is also something that has, I think, changed and grown. The Proms is absolutely amazing. And it's very accessible these days. Many more of them are on the TV. They're all on BBC Radio 3. I think that what you can do is you can just be in the car, driving the kids to school, stick on BBC Radio 3. They'll go, oh my goodness, what's this? And they'll say, it's mummy's music or it's daddy's music or it's my music. And you've got to listen to it. And they'll probably go, And then they'll go, well, what is it? And I say, well, I don't know. And then somebody will tell them what it is. Classic FM has a drive time, which I think is brilliant for taking the kids to school or to going shopping. Put it on in the background. You don't have to start with. You don't have to sort of deeply listen to it. And then actually it'll draw you in because that's what great music does. It draws you in. And then if you've got used to it from the radio or from Spotify or Apple Music or Deezer, I don't know if Deezer still exists, but any of these things, the way you consume your music, you can just put a search in, I don't know what classical is, show me. You can put it into ChatGPT.
Do you think it helps having, over the years I bought thousands of CDs, a reasonable classical collection, and nothing spectacular, but it's kind of, the CDs are redundant now, and because it's all on my phone, I can have the complete works of Mozart on my phone, and it's like is that discovery process, is have we got information overload? You can walk into a music library and choose anything you like, but there's something about coming to a concert that's been curated for you that says, you don't know this, or you won't hear this very often, and you might like this. Do you think we need to change that balance between total availability and actually carefully selected choice?
Well, I totally agree with that. And I think that it's a really good thing to make the difference between live music and recorded music. Now, I do a lot of recording. In fact, the week after next, I'm going into the studio to record my next album. My last album won a BBC Music Magazine Award. I was very grateful for. And that was for Robert and Clara Schumann. And this one is all Benjamin Britten because it's his 100th, what is it? I think it's the 50th anniversary of his death. So the thing is that I think there's a profound difference between hearing music live and hearing it repeated from a recording. I try to do, when I'm recording, I try to create the audience in my mind. So it's not like a studio album, which is done over a month. I record an album in 2 to 3 days, normally 2.5 days. It's very, very, very quick. Not too much editing. It's done in a beautiful concert hall with a beautiful piano. But I think that it's funny, isn't it? The sort of massive availability of something does make it somehow a little bit less sexy. And if you've constantly got, you're being bombarded with things like social media just bombards you with information. Eventually, it's a bit like when we only had 3 TV channels, everybody would sit down of an evening or of a Saturday and they would watch whatever it was, the Generation Game or, you know, Stars
Morecambe
in Their Eyes.
Morecambe and Wise with Andre Previn. You know, yeah.
The fact is that we all would watch these things together as a family. And then we would sit down. My introduction to classical music was Birdsong. So my father was a member of the RSPB in Sandy. We lived in Hitchin at the time. And he'd take us up to Sandy trying to watch these damn birds. I never saw anything. So he bought these little, remember the discs, the 45s? And he'd got stereo speakers and played Birdsong coming down the chimney. And I thought it was absolutely terrifying. But at his funeral, I had 8 minutes of Blackbird Song played instead of music. So you never know what's going to get people into music or recorded sound in any way.
So Nick, last section, and I want us to look to the future. And there's we'll come on to the future for the festival. But I just want to ask you another question because it follows on from what you've just been saying, which is AI and the kind of whole nature of the two sides of AI, which is the ability to reconstruct archival music and represent it in a way which sounds, you know, fresh and new, like they've done with the Beatles kind of stuff, but also the generation side of it, of how we generate music and content. We call it content with that terrible phrase. What's your initial thoughts on that? I mean, feel free to say it's terrible or to say, well, actually, it could be an interesting opportunity. It's just a kind of, in future, will we be going to concerts that are, and we've got colleagues in Leicester who do computer-based music and organise content. We've interviewed a friend, Sean Clark, who does Computer Music Society. So it's kind of, how do you see these two in parallel, or will they conflict?
I mean, the thing is that there's two aspects to this, and the first one of which is the recording industry and composers. Now that is an existential threat for composers, because if people are not aware that something is if it was for commercial use and it was just some drossy kind of background music, it doesn't matter whether it's composed by a composer or people aren't going to really pay attention to it. But actually, if it was a film or, you know, some kind of special product that needed a tailor-made composed film score or commercial background to an advert, is never going to be able to be replaced, I don't think, by AI. But the trouble is that that's not the way people see it. My composer friends in the commercial world are very, very concerned about it. And the other hand of it is that it's never going to be in the concert hall. Mm. You're never going to go and sit and watch a computer make music, play Schubert. That's not going to happen. They're never going to create music in a way that is as exciting as someone like Emma Ruth Richards or as Thomas Ades or any of the great living composers that we have in this. I mean, Britain is so blessed with composers because we have a sort of legacy from Benjamin Britten, who lived in Suffolk. And he just was so successful. And now we've got It's one of the great unknown facts about culture in this country is we've got more great composers per square acre than any country in the world. We really have. We've got at least 100 truly great composers. In fact, I'd be surprised if it wasn't twice that number. And the fact is that that is never going to be, the concert hall is never going to be replicated. People are going to have more and more time on their hands as AI takes jobs away, and they're going to be job sharing. There's going to be, hopefully, people won't be becoming poorer and poorer because they're working less hours. I mean, the French have already got a 4-day week? And the fact is that that means that cultural attendance in France is massively up, because people, if they've got a 2-day weekend, that's one thing. But a 3-day weekend means you could possibly give one of those days to a cultural event. And that's my great hope, is that our music people will see as being for absolutely everybody. And also the other thing is there's no such thing as classical or jazz. There's just good music and bad music. That's what Cleo Lane always used to say, one of my great heroes. They used to call it all music. And the fact is that it doesn't matter whether it's written by somebody who's dead or alive, male, female, non-binary. The fact is it can be something, if it suddenly catches you, then you can investigate it. We do have the chance to investigate it through all this incredible access, but we have to know where to start, where to pin the nail on the donkey.
And I suppose having something to compare and contrast with is going to be essential, because if everything becomes the mush of the AI content generation, but we don't pursue that pursuit of excellence in terms of the skill and the creative capacity of the composers and the performers, we've got nothing to compare it to. It's all just grey mush.
I totally agree. I mean, imagine if a computer was painting a painting. I mean, I can't imagine that until we can create computers that have soul. I mean, it's one of the things I've done in my life is I've really tried to work with composers. So I've commissioned hundreds of composers in my life. I have hundreds of pieces for my instrument that will be a legacy. My legacy will be, well, apart from my children, my grandchildren, will be the pieces that composers have written for me. As well as that, I've actually bought a lot of art, of original paintings myself and photographs. And it's not an Elton John style collection, though. It's not as massive as that. But it is, you know, I probably got 100 paintings or different sorts of works of art. And some of them cost 50p. Some of them cost, I don't know, a bit more. But the fact is that I believe in those artists and I know I've got to know them. And I think that that's a really wonderful thing. So I think, you know, investing in actually consuming culture as someone who really looks at it and listens to it and absorbs it is a great thing. And I think when the museum, when it fully reopens, it's going to be a fantastic space, another great space. It always was a great space, fantastic space for listening to music. And we're so excited to be associated with it still.
Well, let's just wrap up with what your hopes are for the future of the festival. And then I'll give some details out about where people can find more information.
I'm very excited about this year's festival. I think we have a great program with great artists coming. So I would love it. And I would love it if people came after hearing this and actually came and said hello to me and we can have a chat. And any of my artists are very approachable. They're not snooty. They're not wearing penguin suits. I threw away my last tailcoat when we were starting to move house. So my hopes for this festival is that people will come. I'm sure they will. Tickets are going well. For the future, I would love it to be that it was even more inclusive, that we could invite and expect to have an even more broad-based audience, because it is for everyone. I don't believe it's just for one sort of audience member. My players don't look like that. They're very, diverse group of players, and I hope that the future will look like that. And I also hope that we can continue commissioning new music like we're doing on this occasion and continue working with young people and with the community in Leicester, taking our music out to them. I really do believe in that.
Well, if you're keen to visit the festival, the best way to find information is just search. It's the best URL of a website I've seen in a long time, Leicester International Music Festival. org.uk. All it as it says on the tin. Nick, thank you very much for your time. It's been wonderful to talk to you.
Thank you so much, Rob. Fantastic questions. I'm really grateful. Thank you.